The Faces We Wear, a Jungian Perspective on the Quest for Self.
In today's segment, our final, we ask the question, how can we know our complete selves? But first, we will begin by looking at what we mean by the concept of the complete self. According to Jung, this complete self represents an idea of wholeness, a state in which consciousness and the unconscious work together in harmony. Jung sees examples of yearning for this wholeness in not only our own culture, but throughout cultures around the world. This would seem to be proof of its universalism.
Although wholeness seems at first sight to be nothing but an abstract idea, it is nevertheless empirical in so far as it is anticipated by the psyche in the form of spontaneous or autonomous symbols. These are the quaternity or mandala symbols, which occur not only in the dreams of modern people who have never heard of them, but are widely disseminated in the historical records of many peoples and many epochs. Their significance as symbols of unity and totality is amply confirmed by history as well as by empirical psychology.
And yet, to reach this wholeness, Jung believes that we must come to terms with the principle of opposites, that whatever we think in our conscious mind, the opposite is sent to our unconscious. If we deny to ourselves that with good can come bad, with our ability to help can come an ability to harm, if we deny our distasteful thoughts, then they are simply repressed into our shadow. It is not that we should wish to get rid of our distasteful thoughts, but rather we should wish to become aware of them. In this fashion, our suppressed ideas are taken from under the cloaks of our subconscious into the responsibility of our ego and consciousness. John Durley discusses the acceptance of this shadow.
The assimilation of the shadow, what's forbidden to your conscious personality, strengthens that personality. It's like embracing the demonic, becoming unified with one's dark side, which then becomes brighter, or at least qualifies one's light, bright, intellectual side. And there's usually a personal strength derived from that that alters the relationship to the feminine in the male and to the masculine in the female. And depending on where the person is when they enter analysis, one common variant would be something like this, that because an individual had not accepted their shadow, they are relating to males or to females with a desiccated ego personality. And when that occurs, there's a possibility that they are relating deeply to what I call mother's choice, that the individual could not assimilate the shadow to the point where she or he could break externally, if you look at it that way, with the mother, and so marries into the mother's choice or the mother's ideal in a male or the mother's ideal in a female. That's very, very difficult to work with. You have to see what would happen when the individual becomes stronger as an individual, breaks either the mother's values or even collective value, because we're rendered deeply unconscious by our collective consciousness, our commitments to what a woman should be or what a man should be or what a Canadian should be or what a Catholic should be. These are all forms of collective consciousness which limit our freedom.
John Durley describes how the shadow becomes accessible to us in our dreams.
Shadow will ordinarily appear in the same gender as the dreamer, so that with a woman, shadow will appear as aspects of her personality that are either negative toward her, she's unaware of, and therefore are destructive, or almost something like the opposite. They could appear as potential that have been excluded from one's consciousness and clamor now to get into consciousness. So that every woman in your dreams is some side of the more compendious, of the more inclusive personality that the self has in mind for you. Now, if these are repulsive women, that's going to be a difficult fact to face. You mean I'm supposed to let this person in terms of becoming a more complete person? Or if you go to the other side, the same with the men. The men might be dreaming of men who they find repulsive or difficult to come to terms with. A real quick check on shadow is just to go to your mind and think of anyone you've hated from the very moment you saw them. And that probably is a person who embodies traits that your more total personality would need.
By acknowledging our shadow and that which is offensive to us, we begin the task of reuniting our conscious and our unconscious selves.
The repressed content must be made conscious so as to produce a tension of opposites, without which no forward movement is possible. The conscious mind is on top, the shadow underneath, and just as high always longs for low and hot for cold, so all consciousness, perhaps without being aware of it, seeks its unconscious opposite, lacking which it is doomed to stagnation, congestion, and ossification. Life is born only of the spark of opposites.
Robert Gardner describes for us part of the Jungian process towards achieving this wholeness.
To do the sort of the classic sort of Jungian structure, and things are never quite this simple, the process is that when a person enters analysis, they tend to have to wrestle, first of all, with their persona. That is, how I like the world to see me. I'm just a terrific fellow, or I'm just a great teacher, doctor, mother, father, call it what you will. So I think often people will have to wrestle with that identification with that social role. Then I think the next part, which takes a little bit of moral courage, is to look at the shadow in its problematic sense. And that is, well, I'm not quite as honest as I like people to see. I'm not quite as moral as I like people to see. And so by dealing with that aspect of the psyche, one's dealing with a bit of the dross that can often keep us from having a more direct relationship to our personality. So I think essentially what I'm trying to say is that I think the first part of analysis is to try to, is really a process of differentiation so that one can see, oh, there's my social role over there. It's a separating process, to put it in other terms. There's my social role over there. There's my a bit of my shadow over here. And so it becomes much more differentiated.
Differentiation, as Robert Gardner calls it, or the process of discovering the individual self, is an integral part of Jung's idea of individuation.
The aim of individuation is nothing less than to divest the self of the false wrappings of the persona on the one hand and of the suggestive power of primordial images on the other.
With individuation as the goal, we hope eventually to achieve understanding of our inner selves. The goal, however, is not control over our personal psychology, but rather simply familiarity. John Durley explains for us the idea of individuation.
The overriding psychodynamic, the processes of individuation, more or less is this, that the self is the power that orchestrates the whole process. And what it does is depict through the dream the way that the ego is relating to its own interior life in terms of the shadow, the anima, the animus, and this deeper power, the mother, in either her positive or negative face. The purpose then of the dream is orchestrated by the self is to bring the individual into a happier relationship with these internal powers. And through that, into a happier relationship with the world beyond oneself, or at least a more authentic relationship to the world beyond oneself.
By coming to terms with who we are, not only do we enrich ourselves, but we also benefit those around us who are the recipients of the complexes and patterns we play out. Jung said that the individual is determined, on the one hand, by the principle of uniqueness and distinctiveness, and on the other by the society to which he belongs. He is an indispensable link in the social structure. Self-awareness of the individual, therefore, is to the advantage of all. In order to approach, from a modern standpoint, this idea of the individual's connection to the collective, we ask John Durley to take a Jungian perspective on globalization.
Maybe I could use an image that Jung picked up from alchemical literature that would relate to globalization. When he's into his alchemical mode, as it were, he talks about the unus mundus. It means the one world, the one world. And globalization is moving toward that one world. But with Jung, the one world, well, he calls it the ground of all empirical being, see? And so that one world is really where our humanity is one. But our humanity is one only in the unconscious. The human tragedy is this, that as consciousness proceeds from the one world, it creates its gods and political systems and absolutes. And they tend to destroy each other. Like globalism is not the one world in so much as it really, I've sat a conference in Durban a year ago last summer, and one of the social sciences said that globalism is really just localism made universal, you know. The globalism is a conscious imposition of a global economics. It's not the one world that Jung is describing. If one could get into that one world, it would be something like this, that one would go back to that origin from which all these absolutes derive. And one would be able to see these absolutes from, again, this relativizing perspective of their origin as partial and very valid aspects of the origin. Now, it may be solitude in that one is removing oneself from tribal consciousness, either in being pro-global or anti-global. There could be elements of unconsciousness in both those positions. If one went to the ground of all of these absolutes, it could only have a relativizing effect and a critical in the sense of criticizing effect on all of these isms and sometimes their symbols that present whatever the ism is as the absolute or the totality. So you have to get back to the origin, and then from the sense of that origin, realize that it's possibly, there might be an infinite fecundity there in the sense that there would be unknown further configurations of human organization and so forth. But whatever that would be, what would be implied in the consciousness that attaches to this one world, is that one would see one's concrete world from the perspective of its origin and would see as lethally idolatrous the claim of any absolute to exhaust that origin. And I think that's the claim that most religions and political absolutes make. And so our faith will probably do us in before too long.
Looking inwards is something that most of us will do at one point or another in our lives. We all shape the collective conscious and unconscious through our very being. The self-reflection, however, gives us the ability to shape these things consciously and in a way that is indicative of our true and not merely perceived selves. Rick M. and Catherine Kimball conclude for us how their own paths towards discovery of self have affected themselves and those around them.
I'm very much like who I'm becoming. I'm developing a toolbox of skills. I'm getting very much more of a definitive idea of where I want to go. As a matter of fact, I'm going back to school, hopefully in May, to become an alcohol and drug counselor. You know, I think my experience has led me down a path now where I have a tremendous amount of working experience. You know, in 7 years, I've gone to 700 recovery meetings, and not because I'm worried about drinking again, but you know, I think through my life experience and my recovery, I've developed an incredibly valuable set of experiences, and it just so happens that the skill set that I end up as an individual is one of communication, written and verbal, I believe. So I can see that where I've served a useful function being a reporter, but I think, you know, now I can focus on the idea that I have a tremendous amount more in a more important way, I think, to give back. And so that's a huge part of self-realization. You know, I just think that I've been quite a good reporter. I think I'll be a really good counselor.
As we near the end of our series, Roy McSkimming reminds us that the path described over these four parts is only one of many, that what is important is not how we get there so much as the journey itself.
I don't think that to know our true selves we necessarily have to take a Jungian path. I mean, I think there are probably many paths, and some of them are quite compatible with each other. Just to take an example, I mean, a Buddhist path is, in my understanding, although I'm not a Buddhist, quite compatible with many of Jung's ideas. Certainly, both Buddhism and Jungianism, if we can use that word, are fairly free of cant and ideology and rigid concepts of what one must be. You know, they are much more open to a discovery of one's own truth and one's own path. And Jung, in that way, is very different from Freud. I think he's very open-ended, because each person, I mean, if they're going to find out who they really are, they need to follow a personal path, inwards as well as outwards, which is a very different thing from adhering to some set of beliefs or expectations. The whole point of Jung's ideas is that one needs to free oneself from the expectations of the external world. And Buddhism as well, I think, teaches a kind of opening to a greater infinite being, which is far beyond the limits of human society and the ego.
And so concludes The Faces We Wear, a Jungian perspective on the quest for self. We hope you have both enjoyed the series, as well as been even slightly infected by the ideas that inspired the creators of this documentary to tackle such a monumental subject. And we hope, if nothing else, we have given some value to the inner journey, for it most certainly does have value and results. And yet, we are all and will remain a mystery that can never fully be known.